Awesome, like podcasts and stuff?
I've seen people with podcasts less desperate for approval.
I hope this isn't about your podcast again.
Please, podcasts are verbal narcissism for ugly journalists.
Welcome to the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Ben Heisler.
Hello, everybody. Welcome into episode number 44 of the Awful Announcing Podcast. My name is Ben Heisler, and as always, I am grateful to have you guys join us. This week's guest is somebody that I've been fortunate enough to know for an awfully long time, and our paths actually crossed back when I was a junior in high school, and he was finishing up over at Syracuse University. I was taking a tour that day of the Newhouse Media School, ended up meeting some folks later on that evening on campus, and they said, you know, we know this guy, really super talented broadcaster, you like radio, he likes radio, you guys should meet. And I said, well, what's his name? And they said, his name is Jason Benetti. So we ended up getting together, became friends, and he has been somebody that I've kept in contact with for probably the last 15 years or so. The thing I love about Jason is that he is honest, man. He is straight up honest and forthright. He's exceptionally witty, funny guy, really dry sense of humor, but also very charming. And I've yet to meet somebody who outworks him and stays as motivated as ever to continue to be great. And I do think Jason is a great broadcaster. So the timing seemed right. Start of college football season. It's officially back. And also, I love him to be able to tell the story of being able to return home to Chicago for truly a dream job. Now being the television voice of the Chicago White Sox. So hearing that story really from that own perspective is a lot of fun. We dive into a lot of the major talking points of the season for both baseball and college football, along with much, much more. Before we get to him, though, please do follow us at Awful Announcing on Twitter. If you'd like to follow me, you can do so at Benny Heiss. Also, all that great work that you're accustomed to seeing on the website is up and running over at awfulannouncing.com. I should also mention, by the way, two of the great writers over at Awful Announcing, Andrew Buchholz and Joe Lucia. They will be part of a roundtable conversation coming up next week, and we'll also be joined by Fox Football Rules analyst Mike Pereira. He's always great. Looking forward to talking to him for next week's podcast. And lastly, if you guys have enjoyed these shows, want to critique them, or if you have opinions or thoughts or anything whatsoever, please review us over in Apple Podcasts. So without further ado, don't want to talk too much because this conversation went on a little bit longer than usual. I really do think it's worth it, though. Here he is, my friend, ESPN broadcaster and voice of the Chicago White Sox, Jason Benetti. Obviously, we've known each other for a long time, and I met you, I don't even know if you remember this, Jason, but I met you when I was first...
I do.
You do? Okay. I probably sound the same. I was 17 years old. I was visiting Syracuse University for the first time. That was when you were at the tail end of your WAER career, and look where we are now.
Where are we now? I remember her name was Alyssa Hammerman.
Yes.
She was at Hillel in Syracuse, and she was good friends with some of my very close friends. And as I recall, we all met at the Kimmel Dining Hall and sat like and ate bad Taco Bell late some night and just talked about whatever shenanigans of broadcasting were going on in Ben Heisler's life at the time. But that was when we met in person, right? Like, didn't you interview me for your high school radio show a couple times before that, or was it after that? I don't recall.
No, it must have been after. It must have been after that, because I think you had gone from WAER and your work in Syracuse, and I remember you were calling DePaul Blue Demons women's basketball games. Was that like a year or two after school?
It was the very year after college. So I did independent baseball in 05, and then I did the Blue Demons women's team, the Fighting Doug Brunos, in 2006. So it was the year after.
You've done really everything in the play-by-play sphere, baseball, basketball, football. And one thing that I learned about you that I didn't know is that on August 8th this year, you did play-by-play to be the top electrician in the country for ESPN 8 The Ocho. And I would love to know about the prep that took place for this national championship that you were a part of.
Ben, I would love to tell you that I was hyper-prepared. but but the competition, you know, we're going to peel back the curtain. That's what we do on the podcast, right? So the competition was taped a long while before. It was one of those, like, post-production sort of situations. So I hate to tell people, and this is going to break some hearts, but I wasn't actually at the event. We were narrating it off of tape, like they do with, you know, like the Running of the Bulls, they've done that with, and things like that. So my preparation, first of all, my preparation for being an electrician was basically nil as a kid. Like, working with my hands was not exactly a stronghold for little Jason Benetti of Homewood, Illinois. So, you know, but I did get to work with a guy who was the electrician on Bob Vila's show for a long time. So I basically just peppered him with questions before we did it, and at least could ask him relatively knowledgeable things about what people would want to know. So that's what happened there. As we were taping it, though, I think you'll appreciate this. As we were taping it, they were like, oh, you know, just riff a little bit. We'll have some stuff on tape, and then we'll use the good stuff. And so you try and give them, like, something good every once and again. And I said, join us after this. Sparks will fly. And the people from the competition who were in the room just kind of gave me this look like, eh, I don't think we can use that. And I was like, why not? And they said, well, you know, the craftsmanship, if sparks are flying, craftsmanship's an issue. And so we did it again. And I said, join us next, sparks won't fly. And they kind of looked at me again like, ah, I don't want, it doesn't sound exciting enough. And I thought, like, well, if neither of those lands, why am I here?
And that's when the proverbial light bulb went off for you and said, yes, maybe, right. I need to try, yeah, and figure out a different event to broadcast.
Right. I was at the junction box of my career and my time there.
There's too many. As a new homeowner, these jokes are hitting far too close to home for me.
I'm so sorry to cause you internal homeowner strife.
Oh, it's going to be with me for the rest of my life. At some point, I have to get over it. But you brought up young Jason Benetti in Homewood, Illinois, a big White Sox fan as a kid. And obviously, it's so cool to see everything come full circle, even, you know, several years later. And I know that this is still something that maybe at times has felt surreal to you. But I'm curious to learn more about young Jason Benetti, watching Hawk Harrelson on TV and learning that being a baseball broadcaster and being a part of a baseball broadcast can be fun. And I wonder if that was something that stuck with you from the very beginning. Was it something that stayed with you or eventually caught up to you later on as a broadcaster? When you first started knowing that you wanted to do this, when was the element of fun introduced as part of the broadcast for you?
Yeah, I think it had to have been then, right? Like, I've reflected on that a bunch since I got the job and since I've taken over this year. Hawk and Wimpy, when I was growing up, Tom Pachorek, for those who don't know Wimpy, Hawk and Wimpy were grand joy every night. Their camaraderie, their understanding of each other, the catchphrases, the bits they did. Like, when they do an affiliate welcome, Hawk would say, they got a lot of my money down there in Moline. And then Wimpy would say, they do? And it's just all part of us, right? But I took it not only as a Sox fan, but eventually as an announcer, because I do gravitate toward people who like to have fun. Like Ian Eagle, I think it's fantastic, because not only is he extremely superior as an announcer, I mean, he's just top notch, but he also likes to smile. And Sean McDonough is another one of those guys who's just so good of a storyteller and likes to have fun, sometimes at the expense of the people next to him, sometimes at the expense of himself. I mean, he and they all love to have a good time, and that's what we're doing in sports, is entertaining. And yeah, like, know the rules, down pat, know the game. You have to be able to do that, but if we're not having fun, we're doing it wrong.
Where did your love of sports first come from?
That's interesting. In part the Sox, in part the Jordan Bulls, and in part video games. So, you know, back in the day, I was like the first generation that had video games where you could play full seasons. And you could create teams and create franchises and build those franchises. And I enjoyed the understanding that, like, this was a long-term project. And so I think it's all of those combined. And it's also just watching games and feeling the excitement and understanding the strategy and seeing what it can do to bring people together. But definitely the Jordan Bulls, too. Like, not to be understated, when you have that good of a team in your city, you just kind of love it.
I agree with you, and that was something that was very similar for me. And my folks were casual fans, and I think a lot of times sports comes from that family dynamic, or if you have a brother or sister that's really into sports, there's usually a connection there. But when you're growing up in Chicago in the late 80s and the early 90s, it almost becomes so part of the everyday conversation, this magic of watching Michael Jordan play, that it's almost hard to avoid.
And I think we all got spoiled while we were not avoiding it, right? Because it was him versus Reggie Miller and him versus John Starks. And it's not just him, obviously. Like, Scottie was very important, Tony Kukoc later on, all the guys. But the understanding that you believe that that team was going to win every night, like, you could turn on the TV and see a team that's just going to either beat the snot out of somebody or come back and win, like, that draws you to sports. And I have to imagine that people who grew up at our ages in Chicago, because you were pretty much for the tail end of it, right?
Yeah.
Gravitated towards sports, maybe much more than anywhere else in the country for that one pocket of time. Like, the deep care and love for sports has to emanate from there.
I still remember where I was when Kerr hit the shot. I remember when Jordan crossed over Russell, whether or not he pushed off or not. I certainly don't believe so. But those are, even at the ages of like 8, 9, 10 years old, those are memories that stick very clear with you. And around that age, too, like, you're starting to think about this as something that you enjoy. You realize that there's an element to you that you want to continue and pursue it. Did you get a chance to do high school radio at Homewood Flossmoor?
Yeah, man. Like, I know you know the value of getting exposed to something early. It's the same thing for me. We had a radio station, WHFH, that was the highest powered high school radio station in the country. And that's in Wattage. But we also had two teachers there, Bob Comstock and Megan Tipton, who basically, we'd go in after school and do sportscasts and do play-by-play. But they were guides for us. They basically said, this is right, this is wrong, why don't you think about this? How about you use this line? How about you explain to me why you're doing this? Like, we'd go pre-read everything that we did, number one, to make sure that we didn't commit an FCC violation. Number two, to help with the creative process as well, and to have people who are North Stars that early on to say, this is a craft. It's not something just to do willy-nilly, was a bounty for me.
I can't imagine how helpful that must have been. And it also explains a lot, too. Like, we've had so many conversations over the years and how you've always wanted me to pursue feedback. This sounds like this was, you were getting feedback from the moment you started in radio. And I can imagine that's lasted with you a long time.
Yeah, it's so valuable. I mean, I know what sort of guessing game I was playing as I was learning to do this, and to have people say, here's X, here's Y to do X, think about this, and then kind of let me just go do it, and me and my peers go do it and play around with it and have fun with it. Like, that led me to, when I got to college, send my stuff to anybody that I thought was good and ask for feedback, because I just wanted to know how the best did it.
Did you enjoy the intense competitive nature of broadcasting at Syracuse? Do you feel like it brought the best out of you?
Intense and competitive. So what ended up happening was I was the guy who at points created that atmosphere, and I kind of regret it a little bit. When I was a senior and I was running the station, we had weekly quizzes about Syracuse football and basketball because people were getting stuff wrong, and I was a little bit of a tyrant. I think the atmosphere, first of all, the atmosphere there and the people who cared about it are lifelong friends. There are people who I go out of my way to go see, and they do the same when they're in or around the area, and I will love them dearly forever, my college roommates, and a lot of the people that I worked with there. But, yeah, I think you learn, number one, that there are people out here who care about this as much or more than you do, and it makes you think even more like, okay, this is something to care about the nuances of, to stay up until 3 a.m. to make sure that the editing on that feature was perfect, to do all of that sort of thing. Number two, you learn what not to do. Like, some people are total jackwagons when they get intense. And I was one of them at points. And you learn how to handle pressure when it didn't matter. Like, there was no Twitter when I was in college. And so if I made a mistake on the air, literally nobody was hearing it. And it was the same for minor league baseball. So, like, I loved being around all the people who cared so much about it. And there are times where I think everybody who leaves that type of environment, and it's not only at Syracuse, but there are times where people say, hey, I wish I was surrounded by people who cared as much as the people I was around in college.
Do you regret the competitive nature that you helped provide? I know you said that there's... You do?
No, I don't. I think it's the way you have to learn. Like, to be driven and to try to do something amazing, you're going to have personality pitfalls. I'm glad I could get that out in college. Like, if we're being honest here, I was pretty tough to be around at points in college because, you know, as somebody who's driven to do something that's perceptual, but who also is completely insecure, number one, just as a person, and number two, as a person with a disability. Like, I know that there were frustration points and boiling points and times that I got mad that I'm glad happened there. And I'm glad I was surrounded by people who cared about me. So now I can kind of get rid of that.
That part I understand. Knowing you for a long time, I know your perspective on growth in this industry and having passion for what you do and working your ass off to get there. Normally, I would feel like that a lot of people that were also in that situation would say to themselves, well, if somebody else is going to make a mistake, that helps me look better. But that's not the perception that you had, because you wanted everyone to be good because you wanted people to get to that level that you had to work so hard to get to.
Yeah, I mean, there were times where as a leader you get mad because it's like you're not getting the focus that you wanted from people. But the regret that I have is the anger and how it came out at points toward myself, toward my friends, things like that. As you work through being a young person in a field where you're very public, and then you have your own personality quirks that you're trying to iron out. Like, I think if you called my college friends, they'd be like, yeah, he was kind of a dick sometimes. but we knew that it was coming from the right place. Like, they still talk about that, and we talk about that, we joke about it, because, you know, because of them, and my parents were important, but, like, because of the people I met in college, the people you met that night at the food court, I became a much different, happier person.
What did you want to do after you left Syracuse? You had done play-by-play, and you were very good at it, and you were able to get on several more jobs, but was there sort of a dream job? A lot of people have these places that they want to go after college where they feel like, okay, if I can get to here, I've reached that pinnacle. Did you have that spot in your mind after you had graduated college, or was it just the journey starts now?
Yeah. So, when I was 7, I wanted to be the White Sox announcer. And then you get into realism and you understand that, like, well, that's not a terribly likely thing. I mean, I just love doing games on radio so much because I got to do them in college that, like, I absolutely wanted to be the voice of a team. Like a college team on radio. I wanted to do football and basketball. And so that's kind of what I pursued. Like, you know, Matt LaPay from Wisconsin was somebody that I was like, I would really love to be Matt LaPay. He's so good. He gets to do these games every week, that type of thing. So he was the type of guy that I kind of wanted to be. But then at some point, you start doing minor league baseball in order to get reps. And I would say I wanted to be that, the college announcer. But I also had this understanding that I needed to be better in order to just, like, the drive came from me wanting to get better at the job. But I didn't really have aspirations to be a Major League Baseball announcer once realism set in, because there aren't that many of them. And I never did TV when I was in college. Like, I just did radio. So at that point, radio was exceedingly viable as the announcer for a team, and it still is. Like, being the announcer for a team is an awesome thing on radio, and I love describing, but that's where I lived at first when I was out of college.
And then once the TV opportunities came, did that element in your head completely change for you, that you had all of a sudden this whole new visual element that you could storytell even more?
Yeah, it didn't, like, dawn on me. What hit me was that there are more opportunities and more things that I could try to do because of TV. So, you know, when I got the job with the AAA team in Syracuse, when I took over as the lead guy, they had a TV package and they did 20 games a year. And I got to work with Steve Grilly, the former major league pitcher whose son Jason just retired. And he was just so awesome to talk to, and you could storytell and listen to him and watch the game. And you're right, it's a completely different skill set. So, you know, ideally at that point, I was like, well, what if I do both? And then getting to love TV because of all the cool people you get to work with and talk to and enjoy, then it was like, all right, I'm very, very happy doing this as well. But, I would be lying if I didn't say the times when I get to jump in and do radio aren't completely and thoroughly enriching. I feel like I'm home when I get to do games on radio just because I've done so many of them.
Was TV something that initially you didn't want to do?
Yeah, I don't think I would have explicitly told you that. But, like, if you go to the media school and you're the Syracuse guy, and you go there and don't do TV for 4 years, other than in classes when you have to, you're dodging something. Like, let's be honest here. It doesn't cost $2.50 an hour to get you to that conclusion. So, like, yeah, I'm obviously, like, there was something I wasn't very excited about to put my face on camera. And, like, that was right around the time where I was starting to understand that when I'm looking at people, I'm not looking directly at them. And so it was just hard to understand what to do on television. Like, it was all of those very young, like, where do my hands go and how do I talk? And I'm really nervous and I don't know that I'm nervous and that sort of thing. So, yeah, I didn't gravitate toward it. And you could argue that I was afraid of it.
Was somebody there to coach you when the TV opportunity first came along?
Yeah, so there was a guy at Time Warner in Syracuse who was the guy that stumped for me to do high school football up there, which got me football tape. He was my producer for most of the Chiefs games on TV. His name's Pete Gaines. And he basically said, you know, here are a couple things that you can do. And we sort of worked on it and messed around with the camera and he helped me through it. But he also didn't make a big deal of it. And he was just like, you're good. You should be doing these games. So it was a combination of feedback plus also confidence. And then there's a producer for ESPN. Her name's Lori Mancini, who I met at a Syracuse game that she was producing. Bob Wentzel introduced me to her. And she's such a wonderful person. And she was one of the first people I called and was like, look, I'm starting to realize I can't look at the camera and the on camera looks weird. So, like, what can I do? And she gave me some good advice. Brian Anderson has been awesome about that sort of thing too. The Brewers TV guy has provided me with any feedback or advice that I'm looking for, whether it be working with somebody or the types of glasses that I should wear to maybe minimize the trouble that people might have with the look. Like, BA's been awesome about that. So I've had a number of people who said, look, I want to help. And they've made it comfortable because they've set kind of rules and standards. And that's very easy for me to follow the way my mind works.
Before we keep going with your work in the television industry now and doing games on a national level for ESPN and in multiple years with the White Sox, you got a chance to intern at The Score, which is our hometown sports talk radio station. We've talked before about the relationship you had with one of the longest running Chicago sports talk shows and Terry Bors and Dan Bernstein and being an intern for that show. And I'm wondering, you're somebody that's a thoughtful guy. You have opinions. You like to be able to formulate and make people think. Was the talk side of the radio industry ever something that you wanted to pursue, or did you know that you wanted to do play-by-play all the time?
It was play-by-play or bust for me, Ben. Like, I don't... The problem with opinions is they make people sad. Like, when you have strong opinions about people, like, we spent an inning the other night, and I think it was a thoughtful conversation doing Brewers-Cardinals, me, Sutcliffe, Jeff Passan, and we had an inning-long conversation about whether or not Yadier Molina should be a Hall of Famer. I hate that. I think it's a great conversation. It's an important conversation. I loved the conversation, and I'm glad we had it. It's not that I hate being a part of it. What I hate is that we are sort of saying, this guy might not be as good as you think. Because I just don't enjoy that part of the job. It exists. You have to be critical. It is necessary. And because I'm critical of myself, I feel like I can be critical of other people as well, when need be. But we also watch these games for joy. And so, like, trying to take that from somebody in a talk show format on a day-to-day basis, when people, like, you're asking for vitriol when you do a talk show. And I don't like living in that space. Like, that negativity surrounding me at all times and making judgments on people based on yesterday, I don't want that for me, and I don't want that for the subjects of what I'm talking about either.
So coincidentally, how do you balance that when you're calling a game and somebody on the White Sox or somebody that's part of the broadcast that you're calling needs to be called out for something? You're not going to avoid that. So is that just different because it's part of the game in which you're broadcasting?
Yeah, I mean, like, it happened in the game. It affects the results of the game. That's important. I just think at some point, when you make that comment and then you go talk to them about that the next day and say, why'd you do that? What do you think of that? You got to move on. Like, nobody, I feel bad for the late Bill Buckner and, you know, anybody who's had those moments, right? Scott Norwood, like, that's heinous to be defined by that one thing. And none of us want that for ourselves. So in game, I'm happy to be critical of people, but you also have to give them a chance to recover. And I think that's the human condition as well. But also, I can go talk to them. Like, hey, what do you think of this? And then that furthers the conversation on a human perspective instead of just kind of sniping at somebody.
I want to circle back to something that you said sort of in the beginning of this conversation, which was that when you were 7, 8, 9 years old, you wanted to be the voice of the Chicago White Sox. And eventually reality set in. There's just not many of these major league jobs that become available. And at that time, you had gone to ESPN, I think it was, what, around 2011, 2012? So you had been there for a good 4 or 5 years, continuing to work your way up the play-by-play ladder there, busy during college football and college basketball season. So when the opportunity came along, I know you didn't think it was necessarily a possibility, but did you? Like, did you ever think that, you know, at some point Hawk isn't going to do this forever? I have a connection to this team. I've built up relationships. Like, did you still have sort of an inkling, I guess, is my question, that, yeah, it might not happen, but maybe it could?
The odds are just so small. If I would love to say that, like, that was my whole goal this whole time. But, like, rationalization is a pretty strong thing, too. So, you know, when the Mariners job came open a couple years prior, I really wanted that job because I thought I could do it. And I thought it would be interesting to live in Seattle. But then when the Sox job opened, there was a different feeling in the pit of my stomach that, like, I'm really scared that this isn't going to work out. Like, every step in the interview process, I got more fearful that something was going to go wrong. Like, there was a 2-week span when the office was closed for Christmas and all the holidays that I didn't hear anything from the Sox. And now I know that their office, like, totally shuts down and nobody does stuff. But at that point, I was thinking, well, maybe Jerry has somebody, or maybe they like somebody else, or maybe something I said in the multiple interviews, or I had just met Jerry in the second week of December, and maybe he didn't like something I said. Like, it was sheer panic. And that's how I know how important it was to me. It would have been frustrating for another team, but for me to be able to do this with the White Sox, like, there was a point where it went from pipe dream to getting interviewed and like, hey, let's nail this, to, oh my gosh, this could actually happen. And when it got to that point, sleeping was hard.
Listen, dream jobs don't come around all that often. And I get that idea too of there's a pit in your stomach. You want to feel like you've done everything right. You know, you want the feedback. You want to hear back from people. Just the waiting's the hardest part. And I hate to use that in this context, but it sounds like that's exactly what it was.
I miss Tom Petty dearly. But there was also this component of, like, I was bursting at the seams to want to tell somebody, but I didn't even, there were portions of it I didn't want to tell my parents, because number one, I just didn't trust that anybody whose son was up for the job that they would want their son to have more than anything, I didn't trust that they wouldn't say something, because everybody would. Like, I'd want to go tell somebody and, like, say, like, oh, don't promise. Like, no, that's not happening. So there were parts of it that I was just like, I got to keep to myself. And it was just very difficult to know that somebody might make some decision just based on whatever whimsy, and this thing could fall through for 2 weeks. It was killer.
So then counterbalance it when you found out that you got it. Did you go from just fear and nervousness to, was it jubilation? Was it a feeling that you sort of didn't think it was real for a second? That must have been a major juxtaposition of emotions in a short period of time.
Yeah, big time. So I got this call, and they made an offer, and I said, like, I tried to negotiate one thing right in that moment. They were like, no. I was like, okay, well, give me a day. Let me think about it, and then we'll go from there. So I called my parents right away. And I didn't tell anybody else other than maybe one or two people. And it was like, all right, wait for the shoe to drop. And I woke up that morning. Ed Sherman wrote the story announcing it. And I woke up that morning to a bundle of text messages from people from high school that were like, I can't believe you didn't tell me. This is ridiculous. Is this actually true? And I knew when I went to bed that night that my life was going to be different. And it hit me very, very quickly that day that things had changed dramatically for me.
Last thing on the technical side before we start getting into the start of college football and some baseball conversations that I want to bring up your way. In growing up with Hawk and watching the early Michael Jordan teams, and just being influenced and introduced to so many great broadcasters growing up and through your college years, was there anybody in particular that you gravitated to? And I always love asking broadcasters this very question on this show, is feeling out the moment of knowing that maybe you were picking up things from a certain broadcaster or two, and then eventually learning to find your own voice, find the Jason Benetti in you. When did you start to feel that you were moving on and starting to actually feel like you yourself were broadcasting?
It's really interesting. Maybe it's not really interesting, but I think it's interesting that you asked. The guy who does the jazz on radio, David Locke, he was the Seattle Storm play-by-play guy in the WNBA for a while. David had listened to a tape of mine, and they were coming in to play the Sky, and David was like, hey, why don't you come sit courtside and just listen in to what we're doing? And so I did, and I sat there, and David's a really interesting guy. He's a talk show host, but he's also a play-by-play announcer, and he had bells and whistles, like literally bells and whistles. When somebody had like 30 points in a game in the WNBA, he would play a bell or a whistle, and then they'd go do a scoreboard update. Like, it was very literal. But David's a super creative guy. Yeah, and he told me at one point, like, I had sent him a tape from doing basketball at High Point University, and he basically said, hey, there is going to be a time where you stop thinking about doing the game and you start doing the game, and you're just you. So exactly what you said, he told me. And I sent him a tape like a year later and was like, I think I'm there. And then I listened back to that tape and I'm like, I was just making that crap up. Like, I don't know when it happened, but I was on the lookout for it because I think it's terribly, terribly important for everybody to know exactly what's in there. And I think minor league baseball helped me just in risk taking and just being me because I knew really nobody was listening. Doing games with Dan Dockich has helped. Walton certainly is very much his own man. And I also think, like, doing AAA Chiefs games, I worked with with Mike Cousins for 1 year, and he's just awesome. And then I worked with Kevin Brown, who does Orioles games on radio now and ESPN games. And I had not met somebody as a partner who kind of thought down the same humor lines as I do. And we just had, like, 4 years of riffs. It was like a very cheap version of when Jonathan Winters and Robin Williams were on Mork and Mindy together. We played like ridiculous games on the broadcast, and we had a great time. But there are all these small pieces that lead me to saying, like, yeah, I trust that I'm myself, but I also know that I'm a different announcer now than I was even a couple of years ago. So if you say, like, I'm totally me at this point, I think everybody evolves every year, but there is a lot to that. There is a moment, and I don't know when it was for me. Again, I tried to manufacture it before it actually happened, but there's always a moment when you go back and listen to your tapes that you're like, wow, I'm just so much looser now. I'm just so much freer. And it's that moment when things start to change, I think.
I think that's a sentiment that's been echoed on this show before, that when you start to feel like you're listening back to your tape and you're not like cringing, thinking that this doesn't sound like me, or this is something I wouldn't do anymore. Yeah, we're always going to grow, especially in our industry. You have to grow. You have to change. You have to adapt. But I think the understanding of knowing that you sound like you and you can listen back to something and say, yeah, like, I may not be the call that I wanted, but at least I'm comfortable with how I sounded, probably makes a substantial difference.
Yeah, I don't have it in front of me. There's an Ira Glass quote, the host of This American Life, and basically the gist of it is, you grow up loving to do something, and the quote is for writers. You grow up loving to do something, and you consume it, and you consume it, and you consume it, so your taste is impeccable, and you have this grand feeling for what's good, and then you go do it and it doesn't even come close to meeting your taste, and it can be defeatist because you say, well, I'm never going to get there. And his advice is just to keep doing, like, just keep doing it, put your head down and keep doing it, because at some point when your ability meets your taste, that's the sweet spot, that's the stuff. And I think about that sentiment a lot. And I keep that quote in my email to look at quite often.
Before we let you go, I do want to talk to you about just some of the technical elements and sort of the adaptations of baseball and college football, because I think your opinion and your perspective on this is always fascinating. I don't know if it bothers you as much as it bothers me, but you have everybody bitching and complaining about pace of play being an issue in baseball, whereas you call a college football game, and it could be a good, entertaining college football game, and it could start at 12 Central and not be completed until almost 4 Central. And I'm wondering why college football is sort of just pushed off in the distance when it comes to the element of pace of play. Is it just because baseball becomes an easy target? Would you like to see the college football pace pick up a little bit? And are there ways to try and fix it?
I think the networks would. I think college football would as well, because at some point you're eroding people's focus. But I also think that the argument is very simple. The reason that happens, it's because there are 162 baseball games and there are 13 college football games. It's really a scarcity issue much more than anything, I think, why those two get compared as they do, because over the course of the season, you're just watching a lot more baseball than you are football. I don't have nearly as much of an issue with pace of play as some people, just generally on the whole. But I do have an issue with stalling in general, like pitchers walking around the mound and not doing anything. Like, if you got rid of the not doing anything that's not even part and parcel to the game, I firmly believe you'd have a snappier game. People would be more locked in. But I also think that there are other things that Major League Baseball just needs to do even before they do that. Like, what other sport gets away with not announcing replay decisions? Like, Major League Baseball seems to sometimes not think that we want to know the rules. Yeah. Like, why can't we get a microphone on an umpire and that sort of thing? So I love baseball. And the thing I love about baseball is it changes. It's in constant flux throughout its history in the rules. And so what I don't have time for, much more than the pace of play question, is people who pearl clutch when it comes to rule changes. Because if you go back in the annals of baseball history, there was a time where a one bounce catch is an out. And there was a time where there was one baseball in play, and if we got to the eighth inning and it was bruised and scuffed and unstitched and all that stuff, you're still playing with it. Like, I know that's the old days, but you have to honor the history, and part of the history of the game is things have changed. Like, just ask Bob Gibson what he did to the rules in 1968. It changes. It's in constant flux, and we just have to be okay with that understanding. When people say, oh, it's going to ruin the game, people have said that for 150 years about baseball. It hasn't ruined the game. So, like, the rules might change, kids. Like, illegal defense happened in the NBA, right? Like, the three-point line has moved, and nobody's freaking out about it. I don't know what Dominion fans are trying to protect when they say, don't touch my baseball game, it's always been like this. Because honestly, it hasn't.
That's fascinating, and it's such a good point, too, that as time has gone on, baseball has found ways to adapt. And if it's not necessarily happening in the rule books, it's because really smart people are running front offices now, and you're starting to see changes happen over the course of the game and through the players that they sign. And now we're seeing with the impact of launch angle and more four-seam fastballs up and less sinkers and more home runs and more strikeouts. Like, you mentioned that you did a game with Jeff Passan the other day, and Jeff is one of my favorite people ever. And we did a separate podcast about a year or so ago, and he was talking about the dynamic strike zone idea. And I don't know if you guys have ever had this conversation before of, you know, basically...
No, but I love it.
Okay, so for those that are unfamiliar with the concept of the dynamic strike zone, it basically encourages pitchers to throw the ball over the plate at the very beginning, because the strike zone is never going to be as big as it is at the very beginner. Or maybe it's either stays the same or it expands as they get ahead in the count, but encourages pitchers to throw strikes early and for batters to swing early in the count. And as pitchers get further behind in the count, the strike zone shrinks. Maybe consequently the strike zone expands as it goes on. But that and the idea of the robot umpires and what the Atlantic League is doing to try and at least come up with new innovative ways, to me, that's fascinating. And that's good for baseball because, A, it's something that people are talking about. And, B, like you said before, baseball is changing over time regardless of whether people want to believe it has or not.
Yeah, Sam Miller wrote about that dynamic strike zone, whether it was a year ago or 2 years ago, I don't recall. But you think about what would happen if you keyholed the strike zone in the first pitch of the at-bat. The batter would be looking for strike one. The pitcher doesn't want to get behind. And then if you expand it or contract it, you're just going to change the set of choices for a hitter. And that's all we're talking about here. Like, I've joked around. I was joking with Chuck Garfine about this before our telecast yesterday. Like, what if, a la NBA Jam Tournament Edition, you just put, like, a five-point spot on the field somewhere? People would shift around that, that's for sure, and you get more ground ball base hits. Like, you can do any number of things that would seem ridiculous. Like, bean balls, initially, I was just reading this a couple weeks ago. Initially, when you got hit by a pitch, nothing happened. And then pitchers were just hitting batters over and over again to wear them down. And so, like, now, yes, we have a rule for that. And if the rule changed to two bases, people would freak out, just like they did when they were like, oh, you can't give them something for a beanball. What if it's accidental? All the same stuff happens over and over again. The same people are falling in the same characteristics, but pioneering and moving forward is, it's not, I don't want to say it's what keeps the sport relevant. I think it's what keeps the sport attuned to its initial goal, right? Like, the New York Highlanders came in with their own set of rules, and you'd play by their rules when you played them. But then other teams inherently were like, we kind of don't like your rules sometimes, so we're going to play by other rules. That's how this game developed.
Well, you were part of
the pearl clutching.
Well, you were part of that too, Jason, the pioneering and moving forward of baseball when the StatCast broadcast happened last year during the postseason. And I'll be honest, I did not have a chance to watch the Home Run Derby broadcast, but the wild card broadcast that you and Mike Petriello and Eduardo Perez did, that was fun. And as somebody who is, you know, immersed in the fantasy space, I'm always looking for a new way and a new opportunity to come up and find more advanced metrics and more information and find the creative way to storytell it. Because if I'm coming up with a video, I want to be able to make sure that our viewers understand where we're going with this. But what I found fascinating about it too is that you talk about the pearl clutchers of baseball, right? There's so many people that want to hold on to what they think baseball is supposed to be. But this got an overwhelming number of success. The social media mentions were very positive, and you know how Twitter can be. If somebody says you need air to survive on Twitter, you're going to have somebody with an egg avatar tell you that you're an idiot. So how did those conversations of coming up with this out-of-the-box broadcast even begin for you? And can you take us through the preparation for them, knowing that there's going to be people that are stumbling on this for the first time and you have to appeal to them as well?
Yeah, first of all, Phil Orlins and Tom Archer at ESPN, who, you know, are the coordinating producers on that telecast, and they both were just huge advocates for doing this. They wanted, they felt like there was this gap, I believe. I don't want to speak for them, but they pushed this forward, and I was lucky enough to be included. And so, none of the idea was my credit, and very little of the execution is credit to me either, because if you recall, like, the NL wild card wasn't decided until the day before. So, like, the Cubs and Brewers are playing in game 163. And so we don't know where we're going to be for this game. So I ended up doing Cubs Brewers on radio for ESPN Radio, and immediately after went to a hotel room where they were bunkered, our producer, Andy Jacobson, our analysts, Eduardo and Mike. And we basically sat in that hotel room for hours and just went through the players on the Cubs and Rockies. Like, what do you want to talk about with this guy? Where are we on this guy? What kind of creative stuff can we do, et cetera? It was just like a crash meeting. We went to dinner afterward and basically just talked a little bit in the morning, and it was, all right, let's go. But we had talked about the general framework of what it was going to look like and what stats we should include. And we had a lot of conversations about that and how it all should look. And Mike was invaluable, and Eddie as well. I mean, the reason in part that all worked is because Eduardo's understanding of advanced stats and how important they are, while, you know, his dad's one of the greatest hitters of all time, and he has this understanding of baseball knowledge. You have Mike Petriello, who is just an absolute savant and a maven, and doesn't come off as your IT guy telling you to reboot your computer. He comes off as a guy who loves baseball. And so it was this wonderful group. And Andy, the producer, is just a fantastically creative human being. Like, he is a production star. So look, we had wonderful people on the show, and I'm not including 1,000 other people, but we had wonderful people on the show, and that's kind of where it comes off well.
I have two things for you before I let you go, and you've been more than generous with your time. I know you have a game later on tonight, so I'll try and make them quick. One other thing that I think was so cool that you were able to help advanced baseball, maybe not necessarily in a traditional sense, but the idea of finding a way to make a broadcast even more unique, even more interesting, even more fun. You had a weekend in Anaheim that I think a lot of White Sox fans, and hopefully those that have the MLB package, they're not going to forget for a long time. You had a weekend with Bill Walton in the booth, then Mike Schur, who's the creator and showrunner of The Office, and then Mike O'Brien on Sunday, who I believe created AP Bio and is an alum of SNL, correct?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, what a way to break up the monotony of a 162-game season. And I love Steve Stone. I grew up on Steve Stone. I thoroughly enjoy your guys' broadcast. But listen, if Stoney can't make it for a weekend, that's got to be a hell of a way to be able to do a broadcast and try something different and unique.
Yeah, and again, like, not my idea. Wish it was. But Brooks Boyer from the Sox came to me and was like, hey, if Stoney takes the Anaheim series up, what do you think about Celebrity Week? And our video guy for the Sox, Brian Johnson, and one of our media relations guys, Bob Bechtol, had been bugging me like, hey, could we get Walton for a game or an inning or something at some point? And it was all of those sprinklings of seeds that led to those three folks. And everybody saw all the Walton stuff and how amazing and generous with his energy Bill is, as like a human tsunami. He's awesome and a great human being. But then, like, you got Mike O'Brien on Sunday, who's a huge Sox fan and was great fun and told a wonderful story about how he disliked Betty White because he pitched to her a sketch on SNL about euthanizing unicorns. And Betty did not like it at all. Like, I asked him who your least favorite guest host was, and he unequivocally said Betty White.
Which is the name ridiculous. That, yeah, you would have taken it like 1,000 to 1 of all the names that he could have listed. And Betty White would have not been the bet that you would have taken.
Right, right. So, but like, he comes from a perspective of being here for Improv Olympic in Second City in Chicago and grew up in Michigan, but has family here. So he became a Sox fan. And then you got Mike Schur, who on Saturday, like, Walton got all the attention. Mike O'Brien is a huge Sox fan. Mike Schur could very easily be a baseball analyst. He is so smart and so thoughtful about the game and cares so deeply about it and did a deep dive into the Sox rebuild in terms of getting ready for the game and, like, just talking like two baseball fans. And he's hyper creative, and he named a location on Parks and Rec after Sox pitcher Ross Detweiler. Like, there's a mention of Detweiler Square in Parks and Rec at one point, which is pretty amazing. But the guy, I mean, the guy, and by the way, he in some ways was the forerunner to the site we're talking on, right? Like, he created, with some buddies, Fire Joe Morgan.
Joe Morgan, right.
So the fun part about that is, and I think Awful Announcing people will enjoy this, we do a segment on the Sox show called The Swap Meet, where our stats guru, Chris Kamka, who, by the way, you can follow at C. Kamka on Twitter.
He's amazing.
He is truly amazing. Like, he is awesome. So Kamka comes up with this thing called the swap meet we do every once in a while. It's a blind resume of two players. So it's a guy on the left and a guy on the right, and Steve and I debate which one we want. And we each buy a guy, basically. So I had asked Kamka, because I know Mike Schur does not like the Yankees at all. I had asked Kamka, like, hey, I don't want to be blind for this one. Create one where Gleyber Torres is one of the choices. So I was setting Mike up to choose Gleyber Torres. Like, he told me which one it was. I kept trying to guide him into it, but he was not adding it. So I was like, oh, you just missed another one of our traps. And then we did the reveal, and the guy he chose was Joe Morgan. Kamka put Gleyber Torres against Joe Morgan.
That's great.
And I said to Mike, yeah, I said to Mike, I was like, hey, now that you've chosen him, is there any chance you might want to, like, axe him or terminate him or get rid of him or, like, say, fire him hypothetically? But that's the level of creative energy that, like, Chris Kamka provides and our crew provides. And the theme generally for me is, like, put me with people who have brains that fire like that and let's see what happens. And that's why having those three people in the booth over that weekend was awesome.
By the way, Chris Kamka does not look like his Twitter avatar would indicate. Sometimes that'll throw you when you see somebody on TV for the first time. Like, oh, Chris Kamka doesn't look like old Hoss Radbourne at all.
Well, he does a little. if old Hoss Radbourne had a huge, huge beard, and every once in a while when we were leaving Yankee Stadium was eating a bag of pizza, that would be Kamka. Kamka last year, we were leaving Yankee Stadium, and we were like, Chris, what you eating? He's like, pizza in a bag.
New York is wonderful, isn't it?
Oh, my gosh. I stepped on a Filet-O-Fish sandwich going into Yankee Stadium this year.
With or without sauce?
I did not see any tartar sauce on my shoe, but I just don't understand what events led to a complete Filet-O-Fish sandwich sitting on the side of the road. Like, no bites taken out of it, unwrapped, full Filet-O-Fish sandwich on the deck.
Clearly somebody must have messed up the order, and rather than just go back to McDonald's, I would imagine the customer just said, "How the hell with it," threw it right on the floor, and just proceeded to carry on with his day.
But it was plain. Like, if you can't eat a plain Filet-O-Fish, you shouldn't have ordered it.
That's why I think McDonald's probably screwed it up.
Yeah, again, maybe they wanted, like, a chicken nugget or something, and they got a Filet-O-Fish, but Filet-O-Fish doesn't look like a whole lot of other things, like pull it out of the bag before you leave sort of deal. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know, but that's New York.
That's true. I really don't know how to transition into this final question after the broken Filet-O-Fish on the side of Yankee Stadium, but I'm going to attempt to do it anyway.
But it was complete. It wasn't even broke. It's unfair to call it broken.
You don't think it broke by falling on the ground and being thrown to the ground?
I stepped on a united, fully together Filet-O-Fish sandwich.
I feel like there's a pun in here somewhere that you and I are both missing that we're going to, you know, be mad at ourselves for by the time this conversation is done. But we'll come back to it if we need to. Before I let you go, I really do want to take an opportunity to tell you how much I've enjoyed your Awkward Moment videos that you've done for the Cerebral Palsy Foundation. And for those that haven't had a chance to see them, they're terrific. And you can go to yourcpf.org/awkwardmoments, Jason Benetti, with Awkward Moments, Jason Benetti, separated by hyphens. But they really are fun, and they really are unique, and they're honest moments that you've experienced while sort of still providing this very fun and humorous way to help share an important message and help people who have made snap judgments without really much thought or understanding. But what I found fascinating is that you've said that you've wanted to be an advocate of embracing a lot of these awkward moments, not sort of moving away from them. And I'm curious as to the why of that.
Yeah, thank you for saying that, first of all. It's very close to my heart. And the reason is when you have kids who are asking parents, like, what's wrong with that person? And the parents say, shh, it over-stigmatizes having a disability. Like, if I explain to people, like, hey, I get around well. I don't take any medication. It looks kind of weird when I walk. And I can't look directly at you. And that's pretty much it. Then we're beyond it. Like, people will still make judgments. But if we have the conversation, there's no in-group, out-group situation. It's just like, oh, well, hey, I may have something that's similar to what you have in your heart, right? Like the way we react could be similar, even though you don't have a disability or I'm not Latino or whatever it might be. You start to understand people on a very basic human level. And so why it's important to me is people need to know that they're doing these repetitive things. I get people quite often who talk to me very slowly. They don't mean anything by it. They just want to try to do what's best for me, or they have an opinion of what they think they should do for me. And it's not a fault issue. If people keep doing it, it's not a fault issue. We just need to change the rules. Like if people keep going 75 in a school zone, then it's probably not well marked enough. Like, there's always a reason for people's behaviors, and I think it's just because they don't know that they're being repetitive. So all of these actions that happen over and over again, I just want people to understand that I get it. You're trying to help, and we all get it, and we all understand you're trying to help, but understand that you can just talk to me and ask me things, and if I need some alteration to that, I'll ask.
By the way, I mentioned the website for the Cerebral Palsy Foundation. It might just be easier for me to give out the Twitter handle as opposed to all the hyphens and dashes in between.
Yeah, do that.
That was bad. So it's at YourCPF on Twitter, YourCPF. And they have a lot of these awkward moment videos with Jason Benetti. They're really fun, well-animated cartoons. They're voiced by Jason. And they're a lot of fun, and they're a good opportunity to learn about my friend, who I really enjoyed talking to today. And make sure you guys are following Jason as well on Twitter, at Jason Benetti. Watch him on ESPN. He's fun. He's going to make you have a really enjoyable time when you're watching a game. So, and as well as a great podcast guest as well. So thank you, friend. It's wonderful to catch up with you.
What? Thanks, Ben. What about as a high school sports talk show guest? Like, I feel like the accolades dropped off there. I guess I wasn't that good of a high school sports talk show guest.
No, you were excellent. I just felt like I wish I could have remembered what we talked about, but I brought you on now that you know we're on a bigger stage. So maybe that's an indication that you did a great job?
No, I'm grateful. I wanted to reminisce a little bit more about what was it, sports, the beanbag chair, sports ottoman. I don't know. What was your show called?
I think it was Sports and Good Times in high school, and then the college. I can't even remember the college show, but I think it was Sports and Good Times in high school. And I don't know if they were good times, and there were sports, but I don't know if it was necessarily a quality show.
Nice. Thank you for having me. It is always wonderful to talk to you, and I appreciate the conversation, Ben.